times on three times.
Yeah, that's right. Jules getting into that chair.
Yeah, get in that chair. Girl, you in my chair. Get off your chair. Girl, you in my chair. Take off your chair. Crunch Reasons, I just wanted to play, this is Titsworth. Titsworth will be playing on Saturday at Library Square with Senor Rico Uno.
Yeah.
We're about to be...
And Senor Ayers.
Senor Ayers.
Which you also played a song of his.
Yeah, we played another Ayers in there. So, So that's Saturday at Library Store.
Yeah.
Be there.
Or be... A donut.
Or be not Library Square.
Oh, wow. On that hilarious joke, we are outie like a belly. Crimes and Treasons. My name is Rico Uno.
My name is Jules Pixie's Nose.
Bye.
Sorry about playing the not-so-hot Turkish house.
That's okay. In retribution... I don't know why I said retribution. We're going to play the My Science Project now, folks. That show is way more organized than we are.
Yeah. And way more scientific.
And plays way less bad house.
But all in Latin, so you gotta watch out.
F-I-G-B!
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, an organization of 147 member states who represent almost all of the human inhabitants of the planet Earth, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking only peace and friendship, to teach if we are called upon, to be taught if we are fortunate. We know full well that our planet and all its inhabitants are but a small part of this immense universe that surrounds us, and it is with humility and hope that we take this step.
Zoom a little, zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little, zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zoom into the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi there, and welcome to My Science Project, the show all about science and technology on CITR 101.9 FM in Bangarubi. Today's show is going to be a hodgepodge. It's Mother's Day, or at least it just was Mother's Day on Sunday, and so there's going to be some maternal science content in honor of all those with mothers out there. In addition to that, I found a really fantastic website that I'm going to share with you all about Voyagers 1 and 2 and the magical, mystical, golden records put on those spacecraft to spread the word about Earthlings and Mother Earth to all those aliens out there. I'm also going to tell you about the first Canadian meteorite found in 2007 and how it was actually discovered back in 1955. I'm going to tell you why your kids shouldn't have a TV in their room. And then I'm going to share some really cool upcoming science and technology events about town with you. Both Voyagers 1 and 2 were launched in 1977. Interestingly, Voyager 2 was launched first in August and followed in early September by Voyager 1. And although they were sent up into space at separate times, both of them were shot up there on a Titan Centaur rocket. Between the two of these spacecraft, Voyager 1 and 2 have explored all the giant planets of our outer solar system. These include Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and 48 of their moons, as well as the unique system of rings and magnetic fields that are around these planets. Although Pioneers 10 and 11, other spacecraft, preceded Voyager in outstripping the gravitational attraction of the Sun, in 1998, Voyager 1 surpassed Pioneer 10 to become the most distant human-made object in space. It sort of feels like we're just lobbing our space junk out really, really far, but actually that's pretty cool in terms of exploration. NASA has a whole site dedicated to Voyager. This is http://voyager.jpl.nasa.gov, or if you Google Voyager and NASA, I'm sure you will hit it, as that's how I found it. Several of the pages are last updated in 2005, so a bit of this information will be somewhat out of date. And this particular page that was updated back then says that both Voyager spacecraft are approaching the boundary region, or what's called the heliopause, where the Sun's dominance of the environment ends and interstellar space begins. 2 years down the road, they actually might be well into it. The primary mission of the two Voyager spacecraft was to explore Jupiter and Saturn. After making a string of discoveries there, such as really cool stuff like active volcanoes on Jupiter's moon Io and the intricacies of Saturn's rings, the mission was extended, and Voyager 2 went on to explore Uranus and Neptune and is still the only spacecraft to have visited those outer planets. The current mission of the Voyager spacecraft is called the Voyager Interstellar Mission, or VIM, or VIM. And that is to explore the outermost edge of the Sun's domain, so this heliopause boundary, and to continue beyond that, if possible. There are a few fast trivia about the Voyager spacecraft and their mission. A total of 5 trillion bits of scientific data will have been returned to Earth by both Voyagers at the completion of the Neptune encounter, which I think has already happened. This data represents enough bits to encode over 6,000 complete sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which is quite a lot of encyclopedias to hawk door to door. The antennas are so sensitive on these Voyager spacecraft. The power striking the antenna is only 10 exponent to the negative 16 watts, which is one part in 10 quadrillion. That's pretty sensitive. To put it into context, a modern-day electronic digital watch operates at a power level 20 billion times greater than the level of the sensitivity of the Voyager antenna. Each Voyager spacecraft comprises 65,000 individual parts. Many of these parts then have equivalent smaller parts like transistors. And to put this again back into context that is possible to grasp for most of us, a color TV set contains about 2,500 equivalent parts, such as these transistors. And each Voyager then has the equivalent electronic circuit complexity of about 20,000 color TV sets. So that's 40,000 color TV sets in terms of complexity for both Voyager spacecraft. You have to wonder how these spacecraft, when they're so far out in space, can still communicate back here on Earth with NASA. And there are a couple things that were built into these spacecraft to ensure that this was feasible. One of these is the sequencing strategy. And a spacecraft sequence is the set of instructions that are stored in an onboard computer memory and control the operation of the engineering subsystems and science instruments for the purpose of gathering and transmitting science data to the ground stations. Saying the word subsystem makes me feel like I'm in some sci-fi film on a spaceship talking about subsystems. Now, with the Voyager spacecraft being mid-70s technology, there's obviously some pretty big gaps between what we can do now and what they could do then. Nonetheless, it's incredibly impressive. And if we think about what I just said regarding the sensitivity of the antenna, it really does underscore how cool this stuff is. But with the Voyagers being from the mid to late 70s, the available onboard memory for storing spacecraft sequence information is really limited. A total of less than 1,700 words are available between the two computer command CSS memories for storing sequence instructions and what's called the high-gain antenna pointing information. So essentially, the communication that is telling the Voyagers to transmit their data back to us and instructing them as where to go and what to do. As long as command capability exists between the ground and the spacecraft, new spacecraft sequences can be stored on board the spacecraft in 1,700 words or less, or existing onboard sequences can be modified. However, if the command capability is lost and we lose our communication with the Voyagers, the spacecraft must continue to operate with the sequence that's already stored on board. So it means that even if things go pear-shaped and we lose communication with them, they will still be transmitting information back to us and the mission will not be compromised. Here's the sad bit. Voyager 1 and 2 have a limited lifespan. Both spacecraft have adequate electrical power and attitude control propellant, which means their direction in space, to continue operating until about 2020. So that is about 13 years from now. And at that point in 2020, the available electrical power will no longer support science instrument operations, so we are not going to be getting data back. So the science data return and spacecraft operations will end around that time. In 2003, actually, the scan platform and UV observations of Voyager 1 terminated. And about 5 years before that, the same thing happened in Voyager 2. And there's a timeline that's available on this website that tells you sort of how these machines are running down. Where are the Voyagers now? If you go to the NASA website, which again is http://voyager.jpl.nasa.gov, there's a page where it gives updates on the data that's collected from Voyagers 1 and 2. The latest update that I could find was actually from March 9th, 2007, so about 2 months ago. And it gave various information, but I thought this was particularly neat. The range, velocity, and round-trip light time as of March 9th, 2007, i.e. they tell you the distance from the sun in miles and kilometers, and since this is Canada, we'll do the KM. Voyager 1 and 2 were 15 billion kilometers from the sun and over 12 billion kilometers from the sun, respectively. Voyager 1 is a little bit further along, even though, oddly, Voyager 2 was launched first, but I suppose that's all about their attitude control and where they're sent. In terms of distance from the Earth, Voyager 1 is, again, about 15,261,000,000 kilometers away, and Voyager 2 is about 12 billion away. The distance between the Sun and the Earth, of course, is not that big in relative space terms. What's impressive, I think, the most is the total distance traveled since the initial launch back in 1977. Both spacecraft are between about 17.5 and 18.5 billion kilometers away in terms of the total distance that they've traveled. There are two other websites that I want to talk about, and that's because I'm going to be playing a lot of material from them for you today. Very, very cool stuff. Flying aboard Voyager 1 and 2 are something called golden records. They're identical, quote-unquote, golden phonograph records that are 12 inches in diameter. They're gold-plated copper discs that contain all sorts of information about planet Earth in terms of photographs that show peoples from around the world and different activities. They contain schematics about human reproduction. It's all very racy. They have greetings in 54 different languages, samples of music from different cultures and eras, natural and human-made sounds from Earth. So basically, they've got a bunch of audio and visual material on these golden records. And this is really cool. The golden records were assembled by a committee that was led by Carl Sagan. The discs also contain electronic information that an advanced technological civilization, that's up to you, I'm not sure exactly what they mean, but I guess if they can figure out how to work this, they're an advanced technological civilization. Although some teenagers, I'm sure, would not consider their parents advanced technologically just because they can put the needle on the record. Nonetheless, the cover of each golden record is a gold-plated aluminum jacket. Now, this jacket is designed to protect the record from micrometeorite bombardment, And it serves the double purpose in providing whoever finds this golden record in the Voyager probe with a key to play the record. That's in a diagram on the front and on the inside. So if for some reason the outer schematics are eroded, there's still information in the inside of the jacket. I could just see in a technologically advanced civilization missing the inside. I mean, who looks on the inside? But whatever. I'm sure that if there is alien life, then they will find a way. The two websites that you can go to check out the stuff that's on the golden records are one that's affiliated with NASA, which is http://voyager.jpl.nasa.gov. I'm sure you can repeat this website now in your sleep. The other that I'm going to pilfer from today extensively is goldenrecord.org. And I prefer that website. It's not as user-friendly, per se, as the NASA one, where you can select individual audio files, but it's a more aesthetic website, and it's very exciting and very cool. So we're going to start the first of the musical recordings off the Golden Record with this. I, for one, can think of nothing quite so civilized as floating around in outer space listening to Louis Armstrong and his Hot 7. This is Melancholy Blues off the Voyager Golden Record.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hello from the children of planet Earth.
Mother's Day was last Sunday, and in honor of that maternal holiday, I thought it would be appropriate to talk about some mother-related science news. One study that sprung to my mind was from about a year ago. It was reported in Nature News in June 2006 that at the Human Genome Organization meeting in Helsinki, Finland, there was a study reported that suggests that a mother's diet can tinker with the baby's genes. A simple vitamin supplement in a pregnant mouse's diet can, in fact, make her pups fatter. The effect is thought to be due to chemical changes made to the mum's DNA. And not only that, these changes seem to be hereditary, that is, they can be passed from mother to offspring. This study adds to a debate that I wasn't aware of until I read this, that it might or might not be a good idea for expectant mothers to up their dietary intake of folic acid, which is a common supplement used to help lower the risk of your baby having spina bifida, which is a neural tube defect where closure of the tube doesn't happen as it should. Rob Waterland and his team at the Baylor College of Medicine studied the effects of certain compounds in foods, including folic acid and vitamin B12, on mice, mums, and their pups. These compounds are known to add chemical constituents called methyl groups to DNA, and this methylation, as it's called, can affect the activity of the genes. Now, what they did was they took a mouse strain that was predisposed towards being tubby, with tubby offspring, and they fed them these supplements, and they found that not only were the first litters fatter, but then the pups of those litters were even fatter. So this seemed to be very good evidence that the effects of the supplementation were not just changing gene expression in one generation, but this could be passed on to subsequent generations. They repeated the study with mice that weren't predisposed to being chubby, and they got similar results. Because vitamin supplements wouldn't be expected to affect the weight of pups, certainly not in a heritable way, this is evidence to these researchers that, in fact, the addition of the vitamins and the other supplements is somehow changing this DNA methylation or the way that the genes are expressed. So it's not affecting the code itself, but it's affecting how the genes are getting transcribed and translated and expressed in the body. And methylation has to do with increasing or decreasing levels of energy. Now, the doses of methyl donors, or the supplements that were given to the mice, were actually comparable to those taken by human beings who use vitamin supplement tablets. And this raises the really important question of how many vitamins are too many vitamins for us. We already know that some vitamins like vitamin A, which is also called retinoic acid, can be toxic if they're taken in too great a quantity because the body can't process them and they become poisonous. Retinoic acid is also known to be a teratogen, which is basically a poison that can affect very negatively the development of the fetus. Women who are planning a pregnancy are really strongly advised to take folic acid supplements because of the reason that it really decreases the risk of having a baby with spina bifida. And that's why this research is so important. I think at the end of the day, we'd all rather have a chubby baby than a baby with a neural tube defect. But this is really new stuff that hadn't been thought to have an impact before. And for that reason, it's very important that it continues to be explored, this relationship between gene expression, vitamin supplements, and the heredity of perhaps negative effects to the offspring, like being fat. Not just vitamin supplements can affect the health of the offspring, but prenatal stress can also affect the offspring. According to some researchers who were working out of the University of California in Santa Barbara and the Medical University of South Carolina. This is a paper that was published very recently. In fact, the advanced online publication was May 9th, 2007, in Neuropsychopharmacology, which is a Nature journal. And Todd Kippen and colleagues did a study where they looked at the effects of prenatal stress on the offspring's propensity towards cocaine. In this case, what they did was they induced stress in pregnant rats by basically restraining them. And they restrained the mothers three times a day for the last 7 days of the gestational period. Then what they did was it basically got the pups addicted on cocaine. And then they found that through various permutations of treating them with the cocaine, including cocaine treatment with other kind of stimulus like lights, The rats were also allowed to self-medicate, so they could hit themselves up with the coke whenever they wanted to. They found that relative to the control group of pups where the mums had not experienced this restraint stress, this is just being, I think, held in place and not allowed to move for a given period of time, which would be stressful. Litters where the mums were stressed actually had a different responsiveness to cocaine and a different propensity to relapse and to seek out cocaine. Essentially, according to Kippen and colleagues, the mice that were stressed had babies that had a harder time getting off cocaine and seemed more predisposed to enjoying cocaine. There are changes that can happen after birth that can apparently affect a baby's personality. We know this. This is not really new news, but there is a study that found that there's a specific window in time during which mouse pups learn a fearfulness, depending upon whether or not the mother is present. This was discussed in scientificamerican.com, where a study suggests that there may be a critical stage of childhood or adolescence in which the mother can make a difference between the offspring learning to approach the world fearfully or with confidence. And it's all dependent, as I said, upon the mom being present. This was an article initially entitled "Maternal Presence Serves as a Switch Between Learning Fear and Attraction in Infancy," and it was written by Stephanie Morisseau and Regina Sullivan. It was published initially in Nature Neuroscience in July of 2006, again about a year ago. What this study did was it looked at an in-between window of development that hadn't been examined before. It was known that adult rodents that are exposed to the odor of peppermint and then a negative stimulus, in this case a shock, learned really quickly that they didn't like the smell of peppermint because it was associated with this pain. It was also known that young pups that are about 8 days old or up to the age of 8 days in what's called a sensitive period never developed this aversion to the smell of peppermint when it was associated with the shock. In fact, weirdly enough, the pups became attracted to the smell of peppermint, even though it came along with mild electrical shock. What Morisseau and Sullivan did was they looked at what they called a post-sensitive period, a period in which the reaction of the offspring to the peppermint/shock stimulus really very dependent upon whether the mother was present or not. The upshot of this, really oddly, was that if the mother was present, the mice in this post-sensitive period, between about 9 and 12 days of after birth, would continue to prefer the peppermint smell, even though it involved a shock. If the mother was not there, then these young rodents were adverse to the peppermint smell because it came with a shock. Which is really, really odd. So they concluded from this that after doing some other tests which found that stress hormone levels were lower in the baby rodents that had the mom present, that somehow this accounted for their lack of reticence to get a shock and smell peppermint at the same time. This is a very weird study to extrapolate from because it could have implications for human behavior, but we generally grow up surrounded by at least one parent, typically the mother, and we tend to not gravitate towards things that are going to hurt us, I believe, if one parent is present. In fact, you would think it would be the opposite. There are theories from this work that perhaps this explains why some people choose not to leave abusive relationships or other negative circumstances because they develop some kind of comfort response to the person who is in the relationship with them. Although, of course, if you look at the mice, the mother is not creating the shock for the baby mouse. It's external to her. So it's very weird. Having this maternal presence seems indeed to make slightly adrenaline junkie mice. And perhaps if one looked at adrenaline junkies, maybe they had a really heavy maternal presence? I don't know. Very weird. Very weird. Have you ever wondered why, when you have a little baby around you, you talk to it in a vaguely embarrassing way? There's science that suggests that there's a real reason why adults, and even kids as young as the age of 4, almost inherently talk to babies in that cooey, higher toned, slower pitched, over exaggerated way that we all fall prey to talk to babies like. There was a recent study done by Sato and colleagues. It was published in the Archives of Disease and Child Fetal Neonatal Education in 2007. And it was a study that actually demonstrated that when a child, a little baby, hears what's called motherese or parentese, this formal term for this exaggerated infant-directed speech, there's a change in the brain. Specifically, there's increased blood flow to the frontal area of the brain. And this backs up observational evidence where when little babies hear their mother's voice, for example, they increase their non-feeding or non-food-related sucking, as well as observed increases in fetal heart rate. This study and studies done before it on the use, the importance, the function of parentese or motherese raises really interesting questions, in addition to the original interesting question about why this seems to be so instinctive. And part of it is that parents quickly learn that babies respond better to this motherese language. And if they talk in their normal adult voices, the babies tend not to respond, or they respond much less. But some of these questions are, does the amount and type of language that an infant hears influence the eventual ability for emotional regulation? Raises questions about reading to kids, because positive expressions of emotions are commonly connected to verbal exchanges like reading from parent to child. Could reading aloud to children foster emotional expression and self-regulation in addition to learning language? So basically, if you read to your kid, do they become more emotionally intelligent as they grow up? Maybe reading and literacy is even more important than we already know it to be. In the evolutionary side of things, there's evidence that supports the hypothesis that motherese is selectively advantageous. In terms of natural selection, being able to coo and talk to your baby in a way that they respond to very quickly is good if you need to do foraging activities, something that's slightly risky, a situation where you need to quickly reassure or calm your baby down. This is a paper that was published in Behavioral Brain Science back in 2004. The author was Dean Falk. And this receives support from this literature that's been done fairly recently and continues to be done. So keep up the motherese, everyone. Keep up the parentese. Keep up the cooing and the reading to your kids, because the science says that it's good for development.
I should like to extend the greetings of the government and the people of Canada to the extraterrestrial inhabitants.
Aboard Voyagers 1 and 2, there is some Canadian content. Canadian pianist and composer Glenn Gould was included on the Golden Record with his performance of Bach's The Well-Tempered Clavier, Book 2, Prelude and Fugue in C, number 1.
Thank you.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is my science project on every other Thursday with your host, me, Julia, and my lovely co-host, Anne. Here's some rocket science for you. I say this very tongue-in-cheek. Science has a knack of sometimes proving what everyone else knows. And it needs to be done that way because if it isn't proved, then it's not proved. It's sort of like mathematics. If you don't prove it, it's not proved. But sometimes that means that science does what seems to be the really stupidly obvious. And this study, I think, falls into this category. And I say that with the utmost respect for the people who did the study. And I will share this study with you now. It was published in the International Journal of Obesity in 2007. It's volume 31. If you want to check it out, it's a Nature publication. The title of the article is Children with a TV in Their Bedroom Are at Higher Risk for Being Overweight. The study was led by Drs. Adachi Mejia and colleagues, based predominantly at the Hood Center for Children and Families in Dartmouth Medical School in, funnily enough, Lebanon, New Hampshire. The study was very simple. They examined the effects of having a TV in the bedroom of children in terms of them being overweight. This was a rather large study. They had 2,343 kids that they looked at who were enrolled in public schools. The ages ranged from 9 to 12 years. And for these kids, they also involved one of the parents. So we're talking a very big and hence rather reliable sample. The outcome measures were age and gender standardized child body mass index. So not just weight, but height to weight ratio. And they looked into who fell into the higher part of the ratio beyond a normal BMI or a healthy BMI, which would mean that these kids were obese. Overall, 22% of the kids were overweight, and almost half of all the kids, which was about 48%, had a TV in their bedroom. They found that children with a TV in the bedroom had a higher body mass index and were significantly more likely to be overweight compared to those without a TV in the bedroom. After controlling for things like sociodemographics, physical activity, frequency of TV, movie watching, and internet use, they still came out with the result that kids with the bedroom TV, who watched at least one session of TV or movies per day, were more likely to be overweight compared to those who did not have a TV in the bedroom. So they came to the blindingly obvious conclusion that having a TV in the bedroom is a risk factor for having an overweight child independent of reported physical activity. The part that I love about this abstract is in the conclusions they say further study is needed to fully understand the mechanism by which having a TV in the bedroom increases children's risk for overweight. I am looking forward to the part two of this study. I suspect it's going to be because they tend to sit down a lot. That was an example of Azerbaijani music. It was bagpipes provided by Radio Moscow, also off the golden record Floating Around in Space on Voyagers 1 and 2. The last time that I was on the air, I did a show about science and sustainability, and it was in the context of Earth Day, April 22nd. And there is a story that has come out at the end of April that I thought was well worth mentioning on today's show. It's a fun little story about a campaign called Flick Off. You may have heard of this because it's caused quite a commotion in Ontario, where the provincial government has contributed funds to support it. And the campaign is also at the behest of British billionaire Richard Branson, he of Virgin Everything, who has promised a music festival to the Canadian community that does the most to cut its greenhouse gas emissions. He promised more details in the coming weeks about this and launched a website, which you can visit at www.flickoff.org, where you can do various things, including calculate your carbon footprint, get eco-friendly tips, and order Flick Off branded clothing. The thing about the Flick Off campaign is that the logo is arranged such that the L and the I curve together to form what looks strangely like a U. And that's actually got some conservative politicians angered by this tack and criticizing Ontario's Liberal government and Premier Dalton McGuinty for investing and supporting the campaign. The province has invested $500,000 in the web-based campaign, which is flickoff.org. And they've invested $24 million, or will be shortly investing $24 million, in a four-year program that will provide homeowners with up to $150 toward the cost of a home energy audit. I gather the point of this is to help people to make their homes more energy efficient. Conservative leader John Tory said that Ontario's decision to support the Flick Off campaign is, quote, pathetically bad judgment, unquote. And NDP House leader Peter Cormos said parents are going to be, quote, flickin' embarrassed, end quote. All of this publicity is no doubt good for getting all those gosh darn teenage kids on board, turning lights off everywhere and reminding their stodgy parents, or not stodgy parents, to do the same. What's interesting about this is that Branson launched it in Canada, and he seems to be doing quite a bit in Canada and Ontario specifically lately. The Virgin Music Festival started up just a few years ago. Earlier this year, Branson was protesting to do with mobile phone numbers and such, and he was in Toronto making his case, and now he's launched the Flick Off campaign in Ontario. The natural question comes to mind that since Branson is so concerned with conserving energy and has offered this music concert to the community that manages to conserve the most energy over whatever period of time he's examining, if this concert is going to actually be acoustic in nature. As I said, if you're interested, www.flickoff.org. Tell everyone you know and love to just flick off. You're listening to my science project on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at www.citr.ca. And don't forget, if you miss a show or you want to re-listen, because God knows we all do, you can catch our podcasts. We're podcast on the website by going to podcasts, then talk, then my science project. Here's another song from the Golden Record compilation that you can visit and check out by going to goldenrecord.org. It's all one word, goldenrecord.org. This is a contribution from Mexico. This is El Cascabel, performed by Lorenzo Barcelata and the Mariachi Mexico.
Ay, como eres un paisano. This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
So whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electro-pop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, brown.
Breakfast with the Browns.
On CITR 101.9 FM, every Monday morning.
From 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense, and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds with, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds will, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds will.
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
Do you have a favorite font type? Perhaps it's Garamond or Arial or some kind of Zingbat Swapting or whatever it is. Or perhaps it's Helvetica. Now, Helvetica is actually quite an old typeface and is celebrating its 50th birthday this year. There's a film that's been made about this font. It's a feature-length independent film about typography, graphic design, and global visual culture that looks at the proliferation of the Helvetica typeface, and it's part of a larger conversation about the way that type affects our lives. This film has screened at various film festivals, and it actually was just in Calgary on May 8th, and it screened at the Hot Docs Festival in Toronto in late April. You can check out more by visiting the website www.helveticafilm.com. They do plan to go to Vancouver to do some screenings, but the dates are as yet to be announced, so check the website out for more information if you're interested. Some science events that are happening much closer to now and much closer to Vancouver are twofold. The first is a public lecture series. It's happening in Vancouver at the TELUS World of Science on Thursday, May 31st, about a week or so from now. Admission is totally free, but registration is recommended for what is a public lecture by Jay Ingram, offered in partnership by Prionet Canada and the Alberta Prion Research Institute. This is a lively look at the cultural and scientific mysteries of misfolded proteins, i.e., prions, which cause bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE, and chronic wasting disease. And so very little is understood about these things. Prions misfold through no change in genetic content. Something else is going on. The Mad Cow Mysteries Lecture is at 7:30 p.m. The doors open at 7 o'clock. To register, you can go online, www.prionetcanada.ca. That's PRIONET Canada.ca. Or you can call 604-222-3611. And they suggest that you register by Wednesday, May 23rd. As I said, the event is free. The last event that I want to share with you is, of course, Café Scientifique, our own homegrown event that happens pretty much every third Tuesday of the month downtown in Vancouver at the Railway Club. This month's Café Sci happens on May 22nd, that's a Tuesday, at 7:30 p.m. You can come half an hour to an hour to however long you want. Beforehand, they have great food and good beer. And this month's cafe has got Jamie Matthews, an associate professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at UBC. And he is going to talk about the search for Terra Nova. Are there Earths around other stars? The search has begun. And Dr. Matthews will talk about Canada's Space Telescope Most, which is one of the pioneers of the search for other Earths. He'll talk about how can you look for exo-Earths, what are the early results of the hunt, how can Most tell you about the weather on a planet you can't even see. And among other things, you can find out how science fiction writers are eagerly looking over the shoulders of exoplanetary scientists for possible real-life settings for their stories. For more information, you can visit the website www.cafesci-van.com, and it's totally free, totally fun. Please come out. Anne and Jamie, the co-organizers, would be just tickled to see you. That's it for this edition of My Science Project. Thank you for listening. I've been your host, Julia. Anne is on in another 2 weeks from now, my co-host, with whom I will be doing a few summer shows. If you have ideas or evil, cunning plans for science topics you'd like to hear about, please email Anne and I by tippy-typing to mysscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. And we would love to hear from you. Next up is a new show to CITR. It's called Stereoscopic Readout, hosted by Darren Gall. Sounds really cool. Psychedelic garage freak beat and progressive music. Sweet, sweet, sweet. So stay tuned for that. We're on again in another 2 weeks from now. Thanks for listening again, and take care and enjoy the sun. Oh God, I hope you guys get some sun. Calgary's been pretty good, and I hear Vancouver's been suffering a lot of rain, so enough of that. No more rain. Lots of sunshine. Have a good summer. In honor of the little Voyagers 1 and 2 floating around in outer space collecting all this wonderful scientific data, I'm going to leave you with a classical music piece. This is by Beethoven. It's his string quartet number 13.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Yeah.